Hey, thanks so much for listening to this message. My name is Jason, and I'm one of the ministers here at the Madison Church of Christ. It's our hope and prayer that the teaching you hear today will bless your life and draw you closer to God. If you're ever in the Madison area, we'd love for you to stop by and study the Bible with us on Sundays at 5 p.m. or Wednesdays at 7 p.m. If you have questions about the Bible or want to know more about the Madison Church, you can find us online at madisonchurch.org. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast, as well as our sermons podcast, Madison Church of Christ Sermons. Thanks again for stopping by. I hope this study is a blessing to you.
So tonight, I want us to get to, we're going to get into chapter 4. If you want to go and turn to chapter 4 of Esther, we are going to get into that as hopefully tonight, I think we finally kind of, it's been kind of dark. I mean, the whole of Esther, we kind of go down, you know, the first two or three chapters is kind of setting up the bad guys, you know, a lot of Haman and Xerxes, and things are pretty dark in terms, you know, Esther is pretty much a pawn at this point. It's funny, if you've never read this story, I think a lot of us would have a hard time thinking, I know I do, I can't remember the first time, I can't remember a life without having read Esther, right? I can't remember a time as a child where I didn't know that story. And it's like, you know, and you imagine a person reading that today, and maybe there are people in this audience who haven't, so you know, we're spoiling it ahead of time, but we take it for granted now, because if you were just a new reader to this book and barely knew anything about God at all, this story has incredible plot changes, right? Plot twist. You really don't see this coming in chapter 4, where suddenly Esther, the woman, the queen, who has been a silent, you know, protagonist to this point, who suddenly is going to take over. Because from here on, from chapter 4 on, and I want us to maybe cover most of chapter 4 tonight, because after this, it's all Esther all the time, right? She's about to face what I've shown you a few times here on screen with this little shot from a film. But Esther tonight, hopefully, will get to the point where she's about to walk through those doors. There's still a couple things to talk about before we get there in Esther 4. And tonight, I want to, since we're going to be talking about the struggle that Esther has later in chapter 4, where she talks about, if I go before the king, I will die. And I want us tonight to hopefully get a little closer to understand, not trying to have shock value here, just trying to be outlandish, but I want us to understand, because I think we tend to, you know, my image of the felt board Esther lesson as a child, that's great, the queen and the crown, and we too often read that and say, yeah, go get him, Esther. Go through the door. She's going to go in and tell the king what he's going to do. She's just be brave, Esther. Just go in, Esther. Just do it. Well, it's very difficult to ask for Esther, and I want us to be as terrified, I think, as she is when she goes in here, because let's not mistake bravery for a lack of fear, right? Being brave and courageous is doing what you must do even though you are afraid. And we need to paint a better picture of that, I think. You know, I thought of, I don't know if you're students of history, you know, a lot of historians compare these two a lot. This Henry VIII over there, you probably, if you've ever read about history, the Tudors, very Game of Thrones style inspiration, Henry VIII and Xerxes, this is a relief of him on the right. We're going to look at that a little more. I've shown you pictures of that painting of Henry. Henry VIII, you know, from the 1500s, 16th century AD, was very similar to Xerxes, you know. It's a very intriguing story, you know, Henry VIII and his wives, right? Anne Boleyn had her beheaded, had all those wives beheaded and sent away. And it's funny, not funny, but it's interesting because the royal courts we see in English history are the closest thing we have as Americans to understand, you know, had a revolution to overthrow a king. And those courts kind of drew and took pride in taking inspiration from those ancient Persian traditions. And Henry VIII would have been a great Persian ruler in many ways. He was a great man, like Xerxes was great, in that he did a lot of good things for the civilization. He did a lot of great big things that were morally corrupt and wrong, but they were influential. They both have a lot in common in that they put away their wives, you know. Xerxes put away Vashti, or Amestris, what we think she's called in history. When he got petty and wanted to change the law, he did, right? Created a whole new church so he could divorce a woman, right? And Xerxes is very similar in that he's going out of his way to behave how he wants to behave. And they were both very petty and cruel people. And I want us to understand, when we talk about Persia, they did a lot of great things civilization But they were, it was, Cyrus the Great established a very humanitarian empire, we've talked about. It started out that way. But as soon as his sons take over, things get really, really bad, okay? And I don't want to pump them up too much. They are the villains here. Their society was incredibly brutal in ways that maybe would make the Romans blush. And I want us to understand, when you broke protocol with Persia, it was a big deal. It's not just about law. It's not just, hey, Mordecai, the law is I can't go into him. He'll kill me. Well, it's more complicated than that. Xerxes' older brother, Cambyses I, when he took over after Cyrus died, Persia was big on punishing lawbreakers. Okay, that's good. But the punishment didn't fit the crime. One of the most brutal things they ever did was Cambyses caught a judge. This is an unrelated judge who was committing a bribe. Persians are taught you don't steal, you don't cheat, unless the king's doing it. But this judge took a bribe for a small amount of money. But see, in Persia, there was no trial, really. It was a mock trial. You broke the law, you got punished. You killed somebody, you had the worst punishment you could get. You stole a little money, you had the worst punishment you can get. And anyway, this judge had bribed, taken a bribe to make a verdict happen. And Cambyses found out about it and had him killed. But they didn't just punish people. They had him killed, and he elevated the man's son to his new position. He says, I had your father killed, he's corrupt, you're going to be in that position. But he made an example out of the father. He killed the father, and not to be shocking, but when he killed the father, he had the body flayed, and a chair made out of the flayed remains of the man. And I'm not trying to be shocking, that's as gross as I'll get, but I want to be clear here. Esther's going up against a man that will do this, okay? But he made a piece of furniture out of this and told the son, you will sit on this chair, made of your family, not out of rawhide of beef, but out of a person, and you will rule in his place as a judge, and if you resign, I'll kill you, right? This is fact. This is not exaggeration. And that was kind of the least of them. And there are other stories. I advise you be careful going down the rabbit hole, but if you want to learn, Persia's, they were pretty rough. But this happened. And you think, well, that's just a random official. What about the family? Esther's queen now. She'll be okay, right? Not so. Several instances in history tell us that's not the case. One of Xerxes' grandsons, tradition continues, just for breaking protocol, one of Xerxes' grandsons, when he became king, one of the Artaxerxes, had an audience where, well, he was in the audience chamber, much like Xerxes is, and his nephews, his two nephews, royal family, show up to the throne room unannounced and uninvited. Guess what happened? They didn't let him in. They came in uninvited, and there was a tradition where if you came before the king, you had to put your hands inside the sleeves of your robes. Okay? They didn't do that. And let me back up. They were actually invited to this, to see the king. I'm sorry. They actually had invited him, but even invited, they didn't do the protocol vow, and Artaxerxes had them executed. Okay? This was his family. It was that bad, okay? So we see these instances where protocol and ritual were very important to these courts, even in Henry VIII's day. Now, I want to show another picture of this map because I want to come back to why this is important. This is way smaller than I intended. But, you know, this is Persia. I'm going to do the magnifier now a little. Back again to our from Libya to India, as we saw history confirm, and the Bible does as well. But you'll notice several capitals I've talked about. The land itself was precious to them. They were a ritualistic people. Ritual and protocol were religion, okay? It's not a little thing. Our story in Susa is taking place here, but Susa was kind of a winter or summer capital. Persepolis was the primary capital with another place called Pasargadae, and that was where, oops, hung myself up here. That was where they did coronations. So I'm pointing this out to you because if the officials who were doing these coronations got something wrong, they were executed, okay? Each palace had a different function. Some were administrative, but they did different things in these palaces, okay? But it was important, and I want you to pay attention for one thing, if I quit doing that, where Persepolis is the capital, and right above it, the closest satrap is called Media of the Medes. That's important in a little bit because I've got one more thing to say about the Magi tonight. We're going to leave them alone. But They're so important to Esther. Now, this is an image of a treasury stele I've shown a few times, but I wanted to focus on some things. Now that we're getting into the court, I want us to be aware of some things. Just how important ritual and protocol was to the Persians, and how it's not really just about, because some scholars will say, this is a made-up fairy tale, no king was that bad. Well, they were. It's not just about breaking laws. Their entire society was about ritual. In the stele, we learn a lot about them. This is actually Darius sitting there. With behind him is Xerxes. And I mentioned this guy last time. He's doing what they called the proskynesis of the Greek bow, right? Where they'd come and kind of bow, kiss, or the Persian bow. The Greeks hated this because they actually thought it was wrong to bow before someone who wasn't a god, okay? They wouldn't do it this way, but the Persians were different. We learned that this is probably what Haman looked like, okay? Haman would have been the vizier, okay? And you could tell in Persian society, you know, if you were a high-ranking official before the king, you only had to bow a little bit. But if you were the eunuch, you had to go down a little further. And if you're someone like Jehu, back in the Assyrian days, you know, you'd have to get down on your knees if you were a conquered people to the Babylonians. They carried that along. But I'll point out, the officials, when they showed up, if you weren't this guy, you were a soldier. You had to stand a certain way. You had to hold the spears a certain way. And I can't go into it tonight, but there's soul texts that tell us this. If they held something the wrong way, they were demoted at best, killed at worst. These two things are supposed to be three-dimensional, but it's two-dimensional art, but they're little braziers, and if you zoom in, you'll notice a little flame at the top. This comes back to the Persians' obsession with fire as a holy element. Xerxes and the king was bringing the light of their fire, the divine. They worshipped fire in a way that we might see similarities to seeing Yahweh as a god of fire. At least that's how they saw it, but they thought it more of an elemental thing. But this is important because to come before the king, you had to go through these braziers and the king would do something. And that was symbolic of going, if you didn't go through that and walked around it, you got thrown in jail. So everything was a big deal. And I wanted to focus on this. So the things they're holding, and this is kind of getting to a couple of biblical connections here. They often, the king, only the king and the prince could hold these. These are not bells, these are flowers. And they are either lotus blossoms in some of the pictures, or pomegranate flowers. And that's important because I told you last time, the pomegranate was a symbol from a lot of Greek myths, the Orpheus and Eurydice, Persephone and Hades, the whole going into the underworld, and the pomegranate was said to be something that Persephone ate in the myth, and she was taken back to Hades. Well, this region liked those myths, and they were obsessed with death cults, Orpheus cults. And the king of Persia would have the symbol of the pomegranate and the flower because they were master over life and death, you see? They were the connection to God, and you better recognize that, right? That's what they were telling them. They would tell their servants, this is who I am. They would hold those symbolic of who they were. And this is a little small, but this is from some research done on plants, particularly from the Bible. And I wanted to point this out just quickly because I know there's a lot we could say. But, and it's kind of hard to see here, but in a lot of these steles, they were very particular about where plants were, and they even mapped them based on the pictures in the steles to identify exactly which plants were what. And I'm showing you this because it was very ceremonial. When you go into Persia, you ever been to Six Flags or Disney World? And, you know, you go on those roller coasters, and it's like right when you get in line, it's like a whole scene. You know, you're not just in line, but you see props and things, and there's a story, and you got to look at everything. Well, the palace in the Apadana in Susa was very much like that. Again, and you don't just see the king. You're getting to go before divinity. So it's a whole show, right? You go through the gate and you see, every wall you see has pictures of people bringing gifts to Xerxes or his soldiers. You're reminded of him the entire way. You're supposed to, when you go to him, there's rituals you have to do. When you get to certain parts of the palace, you had to put on a certain robe, right? So there was a very holy of holies thing to this, to them. And it was that important, which is why Esther's going to be so afraid. In the palace, they even had this idea of certain flowers. If you notice, whenever you see a picture in some of the ones I've shown you of Xerxes or the king like this, they always have this really wide open flower of a lotus or something, because if it's the king, it looked like the sun to them, okay? They were very big on, we are the light, we are the sun. as you went into the palace, everything was decorated like a blooming flower. Make sense? Like you're entering this, and as you get close to the king, it would bloom. So the architecture was important, right? And when you got to the king, it was in full bloom. And that was them saying, you're now in the presence of the divine. And as you came to the king, you had to stop and you had to say certain prayers and do all this. So there was a whole ritual. And if you didn't follow it, guess what? You got thrown in jail or you got killed. Okay, there's lots of evidence of this. They were very, very particular because there was no difference between society and their religion. Now, some of the steles have this, which is actually this is a pomegranate bud here. And actually, again, if you're a fan of the movie 300, or here's the actual looking guys with the colors, the immortal soldiers of Xerxes, he had them using spears that were tipped at the bottom, which you can't really see from here, it's too small, but those were little silver and gold pomegranates. So when they died, they wore the same clothing and covered their faces, and they were terrifying because you weren't ever quite sure if the guy you're fighting now is the same guy you just killed, right? They had this idea of they just keep getting up. And the pomegranate was the symbol of life and death. And so Xerxes, it was very important that they kept these clean. Because if they didn't get them clean, guess what they did? They killed him, right? So I just want to paint a picture. And one thing getting to the Bible here, which is, I think this is interesting. I'll float it out there. I'm not trying to just say what I think. I'm just trying to think what we can observe. All that stuff has been going on since Cyrus, but during Xerxes' reign particularly, and I'll let you make of it what you will, this is a carving of a relief where they traced over it. I did it so we could see it. They could tell a certain kind of wreath was around their head. And the documentation for this was, for the in the tablets we have, was the word they used for their myrtus communis plant, okay? The pomegranate and lotus were important. But during Xerxes, he was particularly obsessed with the myrtus flower. He had his archers wear them around their heads, and the records show that Xerxes honored it other than other flowers. You guys remember what the Hebrew word for myrtle is? Hadassah, Hadass, which is Esther's Hebrew name. Now, in Xerxes' reign, we know at least by the end, he did love Esther. And it's just interesting to me, either God has a sense of humor and irony, or we see evidence here again, where Xerxes particularly was honoring that name, because we know by the end of Esther, spoiler, he does find out she's a Jew, right? He would know by the end. So that's interesting too. But it was very important. Xerxes had his men wear this, so I'll leave that with you. So that word Hadassah in Hebrew there, Hadassah was the gendered version of the myrtle. And if you'll notice connections to Esther here in chapter 4, some of the setup, Zechariah, I encourage you to go home and read Zechariah 1 as well as Zechariah 33. We don't have time to read it all tonight, but if you'll notice in Zechariah 1, it was written in about the time, we think, of the reign of Darius, or at least part of it. There's overlap between some of this. Verse 1, it talks about Zechariah seeing a vision from God in the 8th month of the 2nd year of Darius, which means 521 BC. So Xerxes' father. And it says in verse 8, I saw at night a man on a red horse standing amongst the myrtle trees in the ravine. And in verse 12, it says, how long will you take no pity? This is the angel of the Lord in Zechariah talking to ostensibly God, saying, how long will you take no pity on Jerusalem and Judah, in whom you have been indignant for 70 years? So I guess rhetorically, I'll ask for the sake of time, think about how this links to Esther. There are a lot of interpretations of Zechariah that all have to do with dealing with struggles, for the most part, during a time of exile, right? And a lot of it was telling them how to deal with this and the promises of the covenant to come. And if you'll read that, you'll see an allusion here to the myrtle trees, representing hope and joy, and it represents during the time of Darius. That's one interpretation. So we see God even saying, we're seeing Esther in motion here, at least in part, Esther's present here, Hadassah. And whenever the Bible says in the ravine, it means in a low place. It's basically saying, in your time of troubles, when you are separated from Jerusalem, I will be there, right? And you will get my comfort through the myrtle trees, right? So that's another link we see Esther during this time. She's coming. She's put in place by the time. And 70 years, by the way, goes back, if you do the math, to to the original Babylonian conquest. So it all maths out. So a couple things about ritual and protocol I wanted to say as we get into Esther 4 tonight, probably some of next week. It was such a big deal. Coronations. A man named Cesius of Nidus, another historian along this time, who was a physician actually in the court, mentions a couple of things about that. I'm going to talk about that in just a second. But the greetings, I mentioned that already. It was important when you went before the king where you sat at dinner, right? He would sit you in certain areas, and if you were farther away from him, you had a certain table you could even speak to him. And if you spoke out of turn, guess what? You were killed, right? So they had this whole scenario. But they had this whole, it was all ritual, where you sat, how you ate, who you looked at, who you didn't look at. And you had to know the rules, or guess what? You're dead. So they had a lot of things I mentioned about bowing. You know, you had to greet a certain way. You better know your station. Otherwise, you're going to jail or you're going to be killed. Worship, they did a lot of cleansing rites before you saw the king. That's one of the reasons in Esther 4, we're going to see Esther 5, I'm sorry, when it says she puts on a robe and comes before him, because Esther knows the rules. Okay? There's certain things you had to wear and cleanse. It took time to see the king, even if you were supposed to be there. There was something known as the sacrament of kingship, okay? Just being in the presence of the divine. Xerxes was known as the invisible king, okay? Because the king, you knew he was there, but you're not supposed to look at him, right? He sees you. Don't look at him unless he asks you to. And this is a current picture. This is obviously, but this is something the British Museum did where they recreated based on textiles and design documents of a coronation outfit for the time. And this is pretty accurate if you do the history. This is kind of what would have happened when the king took on. And there was ritual to it. And what they would do was where it was to honor their nomadic roots. And they would go through ritual. And you couldn't even be the king unless you did this. And they would wear these old shoddy clothes, old riding pants and old cloaks. And they would go through a process that I think I'll skip some of this here. But they would go in and wear that into the ceremony. They would remove the old clothes. Cesius of Nidus tells us that they would have to eat a cake of figs, swallow terebinth, and drink a bowl of sour milk. It was to remind the king of their humble nomadic roots. After doing that, they would put on a robe that was colored like this to say they're still people of the plains, but now they're regal. And that one robe of Cyrus was passed down through each of the kings. And they would go through this showing a transformation, right? But the king had to do this. And there was one instance where a king did this, someone interrupted him, and they killed the priest. So, you know, they took it very seriously. So I want us to understand that it's not just laws and such. So as we go into Esther 4, I want us to remember, think about some of these things, just about how much of a stickler they were. And in Esther 4, we're going to see again, now we finally see Mordecai and the Jews learn of the plot. Mordecai is cut off from Esther in this chapter. Three chapters where he's there and then he's not. And we're going to talk a little bit about Jewish worship in exile. We need to understand that and a little bit more about Esther's choice that's coming. We talked about this just in summary last week, the calendar. This is the Hebrew calendar starting in Nisan here, which is where we're at now, right? And this would be the Lunar New Year for them. They used a lunar solar calendar. And we remember, the important thing to remember tonight is Haman cast lots and then he said, we're going to kill the Jews in the month of Adar. So they have a year to prepare, okay? So that's kind of where we are. One thing I want to remind you of, too, before we look at chapter 4's content, which we'll definitely do some of this next week. But if you remember, I mentioned Susa was agitated. At the end of chapter 3, it says Haman and the king drank, and Susa was worried. And part of some got some good feedback. The reason that was because suddenly people were looking around and going, whoa, this is not the empire of Cyrus the Great. If he can kill all the Jews, then I'm next, right? There were no Persians. Not really. The Persians were a bunch of conquered people, right? Kind of like America in a way. We're a melting pot, right? When you say we're all Americans, you know, if you're a citizen here, but we all have backgrounds and it's complicated. The Persians had the same. And all these people are saying, this is bad. Darius didn't even do this, except for that one time. And I want to mention that tonight. Persians remember very well. I want to ask a question, and please tell me your thoughts. When I put this up here, what do these people have in common? What jumps out to you? Here's some characters from the Bible with a description. Is there anything that jumps out to you about those that they all have in common? They weren't Jewish by birth, but so impactful, God used them. God uses people that are outside of the faith quite often. All of these people were used in a way by God in one way. They were truth seekers as well. These were all people who at some point at least turned around and said, I want to do what's right. I don't want to do what's right by my culture. I want to do what's right. And we see that in several biblical examples. Esther's going to do that. But there are other people watching in the empire. And I'll show you this map once more, and this is the last probably I'll say of the Magi tonight, but this is where we leave them, because at the end of Esther, they'll come back one more time. But I mentioned them as being the wise men, the truth seekers, the scientists, the people who recorded the history of the peoples, right? In Persia, proximity mattered. So the capital was here. Media was the first major province that they conquered in an event that is known as the Slaughter of the Magi. This is a picture of Darius in one of the rare times where he's standing on top of someone. It was a symbolic gesture because the capital of the Median province, okay, and indeed the entire satrap itself, was essentially an entire nation state of scholars, of the Magi, the wise men. This event happened. You might think of them in some ways to Persia. They were to Persia like the Levites were to Judah, right? They were the class of priests. And a little event happened in 522, which Zechariah is writing about, Jeremiah. Darius does something to the people. And the short version is, it's an event called the Megaphonia. Darius takes over as king, and he realizes that the Magi are going to be a problem because they don't always tell him what he wants to hear, number one. Okay? And he stages a coup. He has a brother named Smerdis who has ascended to the throne, kind of a weird name. Darius wants to be king, or a brother-in-law, actually, I think. Anyway, what happens is Darius has his brother killed, in the short version, frames the Magi for doing it and says, I told you, they're trying to take over. We've got to take them out. They're dangerous. These soothsayers are dangerous. But they weren't really. But Darius was afraid. So he had them killed down to a number that was manageable because they were afraid of them. And they allowed Magi and wise men to be present in every province, but only a few, because they get a little nervous when people want to look at the truth, right? And the Magi wanted to know things. And the Persians were anxious when Xerxes said he's going to kill the Jews. This is a repeat of history just one generation ago. The Magi are nervous because they're like, here we go again. All the other provinces are like, here we go again, right? And I want you to notice there are parallels between the Jews and the Magi in Persia. If that looks familiar, they were both immigrants in a foreign land. They really didn't want to be there. They were conquered by Persia. They were conquered and culled due to fear of their numbers. If you recall the Pharaoh in Egypt, right? Hey, the Jews are getting kind of numerous. What happens if they rise up against us? It was the same story. And I say that to frame it, that when Esther acts in chapter 4, she's going against the grain, and all eyes are on Esther, right? Matthew is where we see, we won't read that tonight, but Matthew 2 is where we see the Magi show up at the birth of Christ. How do they know that prophecy? Because Esther preserves it, okay? But we're not there yet, right? Esther and what she does, God, through Esther, preserves that history. And the Magi like a good underdog because the Jews are just like them, right? So guess who records that story in history so the future Magi know? The Magi, right? So it's just something to keep in mind. So as we start chapter 4, and we'll go into the text here, I want you to keep this in mind. Everyone's nervous. Everyone knows a genocide is going to happen. But now we get where the story begins to take a little bit of a turn for the positive. So in verse 1, we'll read the first 5 here. Chapter 4. When Mordecai learned all that had been done, i.e. Haman's plot against the Jews, Mordecai tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes. and went out into the midst of the city. And he cried out with a loud and bitter cry. He went up to the entrance of the king's gate, for no one was allowed to enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. Remember that. And in every province, all 127, I'm adding that part, but that's how many, wherever the king's command and his decree reached, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting and weeping and lamenting, and many of them lay in sackcloth and ashes. When Esther's young women and her eunuchs came and told her, the queen was deeply distressed. She sent garments to clothe Mordecai so that he might take off his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. Then Esther called for Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs, who had been appointed to attend her, and ordered him to go to Mordecai to learn what this was and why it was. So those first five verses tell us a lot about two things. What Esther's been up to and how she's secluded. And it also tells us a little bit about Mordecai and what they know about Jewish worship, right? It shows us what the identity of being a Jew is. Remember Ezra, the book of Ezra is taking place kind of a little before and a little after this, if you look at Ezra and Nehemiah. If we go back to Ezra 1, we see, again, talking about Cyrus, he goes and we see where the Bible says, Cyrus says, the Lord God of heaven has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, appointed me to build a temple in Jerusalem. Any of his people among you may go to Jerusalem and build the temple. And I put it just a couple to remind us kind of how far we've gone here, from freedom to war to all the things Darius has put them through. So we learn here a little bit about, we have to think about what the Jews were up to. So does anybody, if anybody else, again, I'll ask a question if you want to comment. I know it's the auditorium, but what did Jewish worship look like in Persia? There's no temple worship. Have you ever thought of that? So what does it mean? Are there things that come to your mind in these Old Testament books? What does it mean to worship God? What are some things they did? Can you think of anything? Synagogue worship, that's being developed now. They're starting the synagogue, but they're trying to come to terms with that because they're like, what do? There's no temple. There's no holy place to go. What else? Daniel praying three times a day. That's right. They had some knowledge of prayer and that connection to God. And I'll point out a couple here. This is where we see shifting to oral written tradition, where we see them starting to write down the rabbinical systems are coming about for good or ill. The synagogue worship is happening. A sense of hopelessness. They're searching for a way. But one thing I wanted to focus on, those are all correct, but one thing about the mourning rituals, right? Mourning, sackcloth and ashes, their familiarity with how they're supposed to mourn. That's important because that's a very Jewish thing. It is not in Persia. It's not allowed in Persia. Okay, it's against the law to mourn publicly. That's another thing that'll get you killed. They believed that if you mourned publicly for anyone that wasn't the king, your heart wasn't right, essentially, and you were just defiling the purity of the land, right? You had to keep that hidden, right? We know that they had access to certain things. It's a pretty good guess, right? We can see the wisdom literature in the way Mordecai and Esther act, okay? Because we can see through their actions, they clearly were familiar with Proverbs. There were certain books that they would have been carrying on. Psalms 137, things like that. How can we sing the songs of the Lord on a foreign land? So these books were being written and some shared at the time. And we know this because actually a pretty recent discovery called the Al Yehuda tablets. These are a few of them. They look like little Pop-Tarts. They're little tablets were discovered and translated about 4 years ago. And they tell us a lot about what the Jews were going through. They were unearthed in Babylonia during the Persian period. And it tells us about the Jews struggling to how do we worship without a temple? This is hard. What's going too far? So we know the struggle was real. Books like Ezekiel, Jeremiah, and maybe Joel, I would say, if we look at that, definitely have themes that focus on exile, how to deal with it, getting them through it, much like we would see Peter write in the New Testament about the struggling Christians. Now's not the time to give up, that sort of thing. Circumcision was known, but we do see the early beginnings of, books like Jeremiah and Ezekiel starting to talk a little about what circumcision was about, right? Circumcision of the heart. We see them pointing toward Christ already if they're paying attention. They were aware of the Sabbath, morning rituals, And we see Mordecai, by the end, clearly knows about the covenant because of his confidence in the covenant between God and his people. So in Jeremiah 31, we see some more of this that they might have known. For this is the covenant which I will make with the house of Israel. I will put my law within them and write it on their heart. And I will be their God, and they shall be my people. And just for time, this is what we know at that time the Jews would have been aware of this kind of teaching. Well, number one, it's pointing toward Jesus. But also in this verse, we see Jeremiah starting to point out, if you go back and read chapter 31 and chapter 1 and chapter 7, you may want to read those, 1, 7, and 33, 31. They all talk about that idea of worship of the heart, true worship, that sort of thing, that they've got to find their way back to God. And it's not going to be in Jerusalem necessarily in the way they thought it was going to be. So sackcloth and ashes, I want to talk about that a little tonight. A few things we know about the sackcloth and ashes that relate to Esther. There were four kind of main reasons, you know, the Jews did this. One was recognition and acknowledgement of divine judgment. Sackcloth would appear often when God's hand of discipline was acknowledged, or, hey, we're being punished, it's time to mourn. There was an outward showing in Amos, we read about that. We saw sackcloth and ashes in other books like Jonah, where Nineveh's king covered himself with sackcloth. So it wasn't just a Jewish tradition, but the way the Jews did it was to acknowledge God. We see it was temporary and symbolic. You weren't meant to do it forever, but it was meant to get them through a time. Psalms 30:11 records God replacing sackcloth with joy. So they understood that it was to get us toward redemption. And we even see it used in prophetic testimony in Elijah and even Revelation, where it mentions the imagery of a sackcloth. So we know Mordecai, at least, was aware of this, as well as Esther. So they had a connection still to their past. So in verse 1 and 2, we see he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, went to the midst of the city, wailed loudly and bitterly, and came as far as the king's gate, but no one was to enter clothed in sackcloth. Why is that, do you think? Well, Mordecai worked in the palace. How come he couldn't get in past the gate now? Got an idea? He couldn't. Why? One of the big reasons was purification. I mentioned to you a moment ago, it was actually outlawed in Persia to show up unclean like this. One of the main reasons, Mordecai, even though he was a palace official, he could only go as far as the gate because, again, it was against ritual or they would kill him. You did not enter the city in mourning and sackcloth. It was seen as a violation of the sanctity of the kingdom. Remember, they worshipped water, air, earth, and fire. They even had a sense of fire. You might think, hey, if I burned something in it, it would purify. Not the Persians. They believed if you put like a corpse or dirty clothes in a fire, you weren't burning yet. You were dirtying the fire. Does that make sense? They thought you were actually, that's how they perceived it. Oh, you don't do that. You don't burn corpses. You don't burn things that are unclean, and you certainly don't wear unclean garments like that. You don't weep. You're letting out the chaos. You're letting out the bad things. We don't like that here, okay? Water, they even had a thing religiously that if they wept, they would arrest you if you had open weeping in the cities because that wasn't allowed because, again, you're letting the sad feelings out, basically, and they didn't want you to do that here. A little bit of a North Korea vibe, right? There was a little bit of a, we don't have problems here. There is no war here. Don't bring it up, right? They didn't like it. Earth, they respected the ground. Even when they killed bugs, they wouldn't kill them and squish them because that made the ground dirty. They had to kill them with little sticks and put them on. They had these whole rituals. I'm not trying to mock them, but Mordecai was dirty at this point, and that wasn't going to cut it in the palace. That would upset Xerxes. There was a saying in Persia that said, you rise, wash your hands, then get the firewood. That makes sense, does it? Because the idea was, you don't touch the firewood with the dirty hands. You better be clean and before you touch that sacred wood and then put it in the sacred fire and burn, right? Everything has a ritual to it or you were punished. So there was something to that of defiling. Another thing I'll point out, and this is another reason Esther's going to have to be careful when we get to this next week in Rap chapter 4, because she understood this. Esther's been queen for 5 years. Think about that. It's not, if you look at the math, she's been queen for 5 years. She's had to deal with some stuff. And in Persia, we'll kind of close on this, another reason Mordecai couldn't come in is their obsession with the eternal spring. Again, this idea of, I don't want to talk about winter or death. Xerxes would move the palace between all those palaces wherever it was warmer, right? They were pursuing spring and birth. And Mordecai represented mourning and things they didn't want in the palace. So I know the bell is rung. We'll pick up there and finish Esther next week. Read the rest of Esther 4, and we're going to talk a little more about some of the pettiness and things that Xerxes did that had Esther terrified. But we'll see her come through in the end. I'll see y'all next week. Thank you.